We are building a path for the peace paradigm. King and Gandhi, many more, have discovered something core. Now we're building a path for the peace paradigm. Every challenge is another highway sign on the path of the peace paradigm.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Peace Paradigm Radio. Today is Friday, January 8th, 2016, and Peace Paradigm Radio explores the power of active nonviolence. Today in the studio, we have Therese Muganam and Amin Khalaf to talk to us about living in diaspora, and they are citizens of Palestine. And so at the end of December, we talked with our friend Claire Anastas, who's living in Bethlehem. And so she came to talk about the situation that she's living in. And now we want to look at Palestine from this different angle. So let's bring them on. Welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio, Amin and Therese.
Thank you.
So let's get started. Therese, why don't you get us started? Because I was introduced to you first. I've seen you throughout Sonoma County because of your association with the North Coast Coalition for Palestine. Can you talk about that organization?
Right. Thank you. Thank you so much for having us here today. I would like to start out by saying that I am not a citizen of Palestine. There is no such thing, unfortunately. Palestine is not a country now. We hope to make it a country. So I'm really not a, I am an American citizen.
Right.
I was born in Palestine, in Jerusalem, Palestine. On my birth certificate, it says that.
Yeah.
It was right slightly before the partition.
Yeah. So let's get into that idea though as well, because there's a sense of belonging to a place So let's talk about your belonging to the Palestinian diaspora. And what that means to have that on your birth certificate, but not to be able to call that a country. And what does that mean?
Well, it means that I can't really relate to being a citizen of Palestine. And every time I try to go to Palestine, where I still have family and friends, I'm treated with caution, and I would say downright disrespect, because I don't really understand why, except that the Israeli, the current Israeli government, and for a long time, does not want to welcome Palestinians in diaspora to come back to places in Palestine.
And you've been back. Have you been there several times?
Numerous times. Mm-hmm. The last time I was there was last year.
Okay.
And every time I go, they look at my passport, and of course I'm pulled aside immediately and questioned.
So if you're born in Palestine, then do you? Because I know there are some people who do have some sort of identity associated with Palestine, that they have papers that say that it's like their passport in a way that's associated with Palestine. There's nothing like that?
There's nothing for Palestinians. We're completely, totally dispossessed. There's nothing. In fact, my family went to Jordan in 1948 when I was a tiny infant. And so we're not even Jordanian citizens either. You know, so not Palestinian citizens, not Jordanian citizens.
Therese, I might just mention what a thrill it was for me to be at the UN. When was that? About 2 months ago, speaking at a high-level forum on the culture of peace, and to have various representatives come to that sort of thing. And one of them was the representative from the state of Palestine. It was very nice to see that on her little signboard, that at least there's been that kind of symbolic presentation. And I might just add that the last time Stephanie and I were there, we were questioned and questioned and questioned because of some kind of a misunderstanding. Because I know that in your case, they would be terrified of the return.
Right.
Israelis are terrified that Palestinians will assert the right to return to what was their homeland. And in our case, I don't know, maybe we just looked funny.
Well, there's a sense of paranoia.
And
that's, you know, the kind of what we encountered was the paranoia. Why do you want to come here?
Right.
What are you doing here? Why are you traveling together? and we talked about being friends, and we both meditate along the same lines, but we weren't prepared to tell them that we were going to do nonviolence workshops in Bethlehem either. So they kind of also sensed that something wasn't being told to them. But still, what the questioning, though. And so, but let's get into this idea, though. So what does it mean to participate in the diaspora then? And what is your feeling about Palestine?
Well, I mean, I've been in America since I was 10 years old, so that's a lot of years ago. And can we ever put aside our past, our childhood, our ancestry, our family, the suffering that my parents endured? And we were not unique in that. There are just hundreds of thousands of people. And so as soon as I became of age, you know, I realized what had happened to us. And, you know, it wasn't like every day we were talking about it, but there was this sense of dispossession, this sense of some injustice, some grave injustice was done to us. But we couldn't even talk about it in America. You know, when we came to America, it was not okay to say we were Palestinian. Mm. So we never did, you know. And but I've taken that to heart. I've taken that as a mission for myself, because I do believe that justice has to be had. There has to be some justice for everyone on this planet, not just the Palestinians. Human rights for everyone, including the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. And on that topic as well, I mean, people, when you say that, if you see that Palestinians being among those who are the most dispossessed on this planet, when you work for justice for Palestinians, then it helps to lift everybody, because you have
Absolutely.
To get out of your own box in order to even see that how you're contributing to the dispossession of and the suffering of others.
Absolutely, yes.
Really glad to hear you say that, Teresa. I'm remembering Martin Luther King saying, how did he put it? Damage to injustice anywhere damages justice everywhere.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
And could you?
Oh, well, we have Amin Khalaf in here with us as well. So welcome to Peace Paradigm Radio, Amin.
Thank you.
Now, Amin, tell us a little bit about your journey. You were born in Jerusalem, you said. Can you tell us a little bit about where you were born and then when you came over to the United States?
Yes, correct. Well, whatever Therese mentioned about Palestinian citizen, you know, it goes for me, because I'm not a Palestinian citizen also. I was born in Jerusalem, and I got educated in the Middle East. And when the 1967 war happened, I was outside Jerusalem. So I was disconnected from my family. Mm. After finishing my education, I was stateless. And I had to find a place to go. And this is how I came to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I came to join two sisters that I had, actually, in New Jersey. So probably the difference between Therese's experience and my experience, that she left as an infant or a young child. Actually, I spent my childhood and through adolescence in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And that leaves me in, with thoughts of my friends, my school, my family. And I believe that's an important part of any human. You cannot forget that.
Mm-hmm.
So Jerusalem and home for me is something special,
mm-hmm.
though I have been in the United States for such a long time.
Mm-hmm. And so with that, how do you talk to people about Palestine? Does it come up in your conversations with people, or do you feel like you have to not talk about it and just assimilate into whatever is around you?
Well, what Therese mentioned about in the United States, very hard to talk about Palestine or Palestinians. Mm-hmm. It is the position of the American policy and the people, as a matter of fact, is it's a very delicate subject. Mm-hmm. So it's not easy to talk about that. However, by time, we reach a point where seeing the injustice, just we have to be open about it. Mm-hmm. And this is now, I see it more than a personal problem. Mm. It is actually a bigger problem than me. It is just injustice happening. And we need to right the wrong. So that's how I talk to people about it. I talk about everything that's happening wrong and how could we make it right.
Yeah. In fact, I wanted to ask each of you to talk about the work that you do here in correcting injustices, and perhaps also you could tell me how you felt during the intifadas, especially the first intifada. Did you look upon that with a great deal of hope, as some of us did here? What was it like watching that from the sidelines? So take the other question first, though. What about your work here?
Well, I think the major part of my work through the years has been to expose the American people that I know in my community to a different narrative of what really happened to us, to my family in particular, but not as a unique happening. It happened to so many others, as I said earlier. So, and I feel that so many people, when they listened, when they really, because at first they knew me and they thought, oh, well, she's a pretty nice lady, you know, maybe she's telling me the truth, you know. So the credibility was there. And so when they finally, many of them, when they finally got the story, it's like, really? That really happened to you? That seems so unfair that that happened to you. So my work continues to be, believe it or not, to this day, trying to help people understand what is really going on, because the media is not helpful there at all to bring in the Palestinian side of the story. The Palestinians have been demonized, as Arabs have been demonized. If you've seen that movie, Real, R-E-E-L, Bad Arabs, I really recommend it because it shows how the media for decades has been really demonizing the Arabs in the Hollywood image of what terrible people they are. And so the basic part of my work has been to educate people mm-hmm. about what the Palestinian story really is.
Mm-hmm. Can you share a bit of that with our listeners?
About the Palestinian story?
Yeah. What is, like, if somebody who knows very little about the situation, where would you start? What would you say to them?
Well, I mean, I would start with what happened to my family. I mean, in 1948. I mean, I was born in 47. I was just a few months old when, you know, the United Nations divided Palestine totally arbitrarily, not negotiating with the local people there, just imposing a partition on them and giving over 56%, you know, over half, about 56% of Palestine to a Jewish people. Now, I know that that's a whole other narrative because the Jewish people got there. And anyway, that's another whole story, which we're not here to explore today. But so, okay, so but 800,000 Palestinians had to be emptied out of the part of Palestine that was given over to the Jewish state. So what happened to these people? I mean, that's a lot of people. It's the majority of the Palestinians at the time. And so they all became refugees, and my family in particular. I mean, there were massacres, and there were, you know, talk about terrorism. It was going on then. And not far from where we lived, and both Amin and I lived near Jerusalem. Well, you lived in Jerusalem, and I lived near Jerusalem in Ramallah, my family, just a couple of miles from Jerusalem. Deir Yassin was there. I mean, the massacre that happened in one day, that everybody in town, the men and the women and the children and the elders, everybody was massacred. And people are afraid of things like that. And so a lot of people fled, including my family. And so we went across the river to Jordan. And my dad was a teacher. And he was able to find a job with the Patriarchate of Jerusalem, which was also on the other side in Jordan. And that's where I spent. I mean, I don't remember Palestine because I was an infant, but I remember Jordan because I spent the first 10 years of my life. And so, but what happened to those, the others who had to flee or at the point of a gun, many of them? They are still living in refugee camps all over the Arab world, in Syria. Well, Syria, boy, that's another whole story because they're no longer there. But in, you know, in Gaza, in Jordan, in Lebanon. And they're still waiting, believe it or not, tragically. And I've been to some of those refugee camps. And people now, third generation, maybe it was about 700,000 to 800,000 at that time. It's like 3 to 4 million people now. And they're still waiting to go back to their homes or to be compensated for their losses. You know, and it's really quite tragic because some of them still have the keys to the homes that they fled from. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so that's part of it.
Well, that's part of it, all right. I know Awakening came for me, interestingly enough, in Europe. I was a student in Europe. Over here, I heard nothing about it. And I started hearing from friends from South Africa and so forth, how aggressive that expulsion had been. And then with a great sense of shock, I was visiting a friend, a high school friend, in Jerusalem. He lived in a very nice house in a long Rehav, big street in Jerusalem. And I walking out the door and seeing that this had been the home of an Arab family, that there was Arab calligraphy in the floor, that made it very real for me. And I wonder if you are aware of I guess it's a program or an organization called If America Knew.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And then Amos Gvirtz, whom we interviewed a while back, not on this program, he has almost a daily email called Don't Pretend That You Didn't Know. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a theory about why a lot of Americans don't want to know what happened to the Palestinians. And it's not primarily because they don't care. It's primarily because of the guilt that they know that, you know, they were behind it in one way or another, and they still are. And they have a very comfortable narrative about Jewish victimization, which God knows, you know, was true. And I noticed in my study of Gandhi how very careful he is to try always to sidestep people's feelings of humiliation or guilt. That it's very difficult to get people to face that. And so if we could construct a narrative which would start with some kind of meme like, it's perfectly understandable why you, thinking of the Israelis, why you might be paranoid. This has gone on for you for 2,000 years. But now is now. Where have you, you know, and I know that, I don't know if you've seen the film Gatekeepers.
Yes.
So you know that the Shin Bet, which kind of understands the dynamics of things, they're saying, quote, we're winning every battle and losing the war, that there cannot be a military way to peace. So I'm thinking that, you know, given our nonviolence background, whether there might be an entree that way, you know, being very sensitive to the feelings on both sides and then being able to use that common understanding to arrive at the truth and move forward some way from there.
If you are directing the question to me, I'll be more than happy to answer it. I was fortunate to come across and meet actually a few number of Israelis, which I did not have before. And I noticed that the Israeli citizens are in the dark as much as Americans. I was surprised.
Yeah.
And that made me think that actually the policy of the government of Israel, I want to separate that from Israelis or Jews or Jewish, it use the means of non-information, not informing the people as a way to implement their policies. So when it comes to the realities in Israel, and you talk about the American citizens and the guilt, it has been since the establishment of Israel that Israel used that methodically not to inform about what really is going on in Palestine, neither for the Palestinian nor for everybody else. They are implementing their policies. At this point, we know very well that there is a wall that's separating Palestine. And that wall, I think, extends around 700 kilometers at 32 feet high. The wisdom of that wall, by the way, many people find it in security. It is not for security. It is not at all for security. And I, as somebody talk about the culture, I care about explaining. It is for separating the Israeli citizens from the Palestinian citizens. It is so important for Israel as a government to separate that, because the people talking to each other will create a message somehow of peace. Mm. And that is very fundamental to implement these policies. To touch on the idea of the American guilt, I agree with that. But also, we have a job over here to do, which is to educate Americans. And I found tremendously open-minded people. You tell them the truth. American people are good people, I mean, from my experience with them. And if you explain to them and they know the truth, certainly they will find a way to learn about these issues. What I encounter in the United States is people who are not aware. Mm-hmm. And we could understand that that is something that is, there's a cover up by the media. Yes. The media itself is complicit in that.
I think, yes, I totally agree with what you just said, Amin. And there's also, you know, so you're saying, well, what to do and how not to shame people, because you don't want to do that, because that creates more damage, I think, psychically and so on. I just, quite honestly, I'll just say it. I think the whole thing of Zionism, the whole ideology of Zionism, is really what is at fault here. Because, you know, the Palestinians for at least over 10 years now have had a resolution, you know, that they would take 22% of original Palestine. You know, but I think that the Zionist ideology is no. I mean, clearly, because they keep building, you know, the wall, and the wall actually cuts into what is supposed to have been Palestine. And I think that that's the part that really needs to be addressed, this Zionist ideology that says all of Palestine is ours and we're going to try to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. That's the part that I think is really, really offensive to me as a Palestinian and as a human being.
Well, you know what, Therese? It's offensive to me as a Jewish American.
Well, that's because you're human.
Thank you. I think that, and I've been saying this for quite a while, I think that Israel has created a monster in the settlement culture and in the version of Zionism that you're talking about. Because there are Zionists who feel that they should not, it has nothing to do with real
yes.
estate, and we're making a big mistake. And we should carry, what they need to carry forward is Jewish culture. So, but anyway, they've created this monster, and I really, it's hard to think how to help them de-Frankenstein these people. I know there was of course, the one evacuation of Gaza, settlers that were moved out of Gaza. That didn't work too well, and didn't mean too much. But I think we need to reverse the education that's given to Israeli children. When I see the way that children are taught to hate, it just makes my flesh creep, frankly. And we need to reassure the Jewish people that they can be secure without having a modern nation state that excludes everybody, that gives them trouble. And I know I was talking to a Sabra friend of mine recently who was very active in nonviolence, and she said, you know, the idea of us being protected in these little pockets all around the world didn't work very well. And but I said, you know, having a nation state of our own hasn't worked very well either.
Right.
So it's as you were saying. I mean, we need to change the culture. We need to change the mentality of enough people. Then I think any kind of political solution could be worked out.
Exactly. I agree with you. And one thing that you mentioned about you yourself, you are Jewish, and I have lots of Jewish friends, and I'm not an authority on the Jewish religion, but generally speaking, I don't think the Jewish religion subscribe by any chance to violence or cleansing or any of the practices of the government of Israel. So we have to be careful about attaching that to the Jewish religion per se. The government of Israel, as implementing their policies, their brand of Zionism, mm-hmm. is not something that I personally could associate with a good Jewish religion thinking. Mm-hmm. But they use religion as justification for their existence. The one thing that I would like to mention about the education issue, it is the American populace need to be educated about the facts of what's happening, and the Israelis as well, because I was surprised that the Israeli citizens don't know, actually, mm-hmm. after meeting with them. This is what I do in my courses. I try to educate people about the Middle East. And it doesn't go just about the history of Palestine, but it goes back thousands of years to the ancient history, because we could view a scope of culture from the Romans and the Egyptians to this time. And this will help people to understand the idea of what's going on in the Middle East right now, beyond the boundaries, you know, the boundaries of Palestine, in Syria and in Iraq, actually is something that we have to understand. It is not part of the Middle East. It is due to the influence from outside, to some hands playing with the people, the countries, and the culture there that create this dire situation that we have now in the Middle East.
Well, that's most obviously true today, perhaps in Syria.
That's true.
But it's true everywhere. And I think wherever there is superpower interference, things go bad. And I have to say that in the last couple of years, I think I've started to notice a little bit of an opening, a little bit of a break. The people saying that, well, for example, that statement that there is no military way towards peace, you almost never heard that in the mass media or in film or anywhere. Now, I've been doing this general work in nonviolence for like about 30 years. I'm starting to notice a bit of an opening, which maybe just comes from the frustration of having tried, you know, what we did in Vietnam, what we did in Iraq, rolling it over again and again, and how hopeless it seems to be. People are starting to scratch their heads just a little bit here and there and look for an alternative. And I'm encouraged by that because it doesn't take much. You know, we have studies now that show that if 3.5% of the population wants things different, that will be unstoppable. Yeah, this is good political science, has shown us this. And so I'm wondering if in the work that you two have been doing, you're noticing a little more receptivity, a little more quickness on the uptake. Therese?
Absolutely.
Great.
Over the last, I would say, 25 years since I've started doing this mm-hmm. work, I'm just amazed at the openness and receptivity of people. Of course, it helps to make human contact with people so that they can see. I mean, I've had people who didn't know me after giving a talk about, the history, the origin of the conflict, actually come up to me Jewish people and say to me, honey, are you sure you're Palestinian? I am not kidding. They couldn't believe that I was Palestinian. It's like they had this image.
Yeah.
And it comes again from that movie I mentioned earlier, R-E-E-L, Real, Real Live Arabs. I think that's what it is. And so I have seen, I mean, four of the people in our small North Coast Coalition for Palestine are Jewish. I mean, you know, they are really concerned about furthering this process of peace and understanding for Palestinians as well as Israelis. Mm-hmm. And that that group that you mentioned earlier, If Americans Knew, that says it. If Americans really knew, they really wouldn't stand for it. Plus the fact that so much of our tax dollars go to support that conflict. If more of us, more than 3.5%, knew that reality, we wouldn't stand for it because it's unjust. And most people in their heart of hearts don't like injustice.
Mm-hmm. And it also for me brings out this notion that knowledge doesn't mean passivity. When we know something, we have to act on it.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, we become it. We get involved. And so the knowledge, the work of education in that way can be very, very powerful. But do you see any other solutions as well? Because whenever I think about the issue, I feel frustration. I feel, you know, also the groups that are involved as well. Sometimes I'm wondering, you know, what solutions are they working toward? It's almost become, there's probably thousands of organizations now that are working on the issue that their existence depends on the conflict in a way. So can you discuss this idea of what kinds of solutions are people working toward, and are outside groups making the situation, you know, worse? Those who are for the cause and for the education, is it helping, and why? If it is helping, why? And if it's not helping, why is it not?
Yes. Well, I think that the system in the United States, per se, we complain about it, by the way, as American citizens, the voting system, the campaign funding. We cannot separate that from the general problem. I'm not going to get into this subject, which is very complex. But the ills of our system internally that we have in politics, and in voting and in funding and campaigns extend to the power of the corporations. And the power of the corporations are shaping that, muting actually the facts and the truth by controlling the networks, TV, and all media outlets. Now, having that system broken, if I could describe it, the American people would understand, if you could explain to them, that broken system is broken on the outside. Mm. So our foreign policy, per se, is broken down. And that's why we have all these mishaps in the Middle East. We have the mishap in the Middle East because of policies that is not wise. And it is not to our interest, as a matter of fact. And some of them is like supporting the state of Israel in doing illegal things. All what we need is every state to abide by the international law. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that.
And of course, with that, I mean, that was perfect, yes. With that, we also know that the answers are not coming, will never come from our fearless leaders, you know, or Congress, or, you know, that's not where it's coming from. And it gives me great hope to know, and to actually, I don't know if you knew that Iyad Burnett was here recently. Did you also have him here?
We didn't have him on the show, but he's a great friend, and I was just about to announce that his book is out.
Oh, fantastic.
Yep, he wrote a book called Bilin and the Nonviolent Resistance.
Right.
And the 50 copies are on their way to the Meta Center as we speak.
Beautiful.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. Beautiful. So he started this he and many others, mm-hmm. of course, the nonviolent movement that's taking place in many, many villages in Palestine, in the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is real hope there now. more than in anything else. And I think that the Palestinians, you know, the indigenous Palestinians have finally figured out. We tried everything. We tried the Intifada. We tried, you know, suicide bombers out of total hopelessness and desperation. See, I believe that people have a right to resist. How they resist is another question. Mm-hmm. And so now they are resisting by these organized, nonviolent demonstrations taking place, which gives me great hope.
And I think even Gandhi would say that not just a right, but it's a duty to resist.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes.
You know, I can't go into the details, but I think that spirit of puzzlement about the violent resistance, the armed struggle, and the willingness to look at nonviolent struggle has spread to Gaza. So this is something that's being looked at seriously by Hamas. And that's why I was wanted to ask you about how you felt about the first Intifada and why, how unfortunately it got frustrated after Oslo. And do you think that spirit could move again?
you know, the Intifada happened when I was in the United States, of course. And mm-hmm. always we see things from a distance and we just hope the people there, and we trust them that they are doing the right thing. Because from a distance, it's very hard to judge the people, what they are doing. But one thing I know, and I heard stories about the way Israel treated that. They treated the people who did Al-Intifada with so much force that actually shows that they have no tolerance whatsoever for anybody to speak the truth or resist. And this is how they exist, actually, on that. So going back to the Intifada, of course, it is the right of the people there to do whatever they believe it will accomplish something. But we, on the outside, our mission is to make people more aware of what's right and what's wrong, and hopefully just open the minds of people.
I'm happy to add that nonviolence doesn't really depend on your opponent being open-minded and willing to accept. And in fact, sometimes if you play your cards right, the more violently they try to repress you, the more progress you make. Mm-hmm. It's called the paradox of repression. It hurts. But if you play it correctly, there's a kind of jujitsu there. And I think that, you know, my friends like Mubarak Awad and others who were promoting the nonviolence, they're quite aware of this. And it becomes a question. It's interesting. On the one hand, we need the average Israeli citizen to understand the violence that they're doing to the Palestinians. But we need the resistors, both Jewish and Palestinian, to understand more accurately the dynamics of nonviolence. Because I think, and from Damascus comes some of the best work on nonviolence in Arabic.
Yes,
and in fact, I've been invited to write a series of articles that'll be published by Ma'aber in Arabic, and mm-hmm. I think these two directions converging. You know, the keener knowledge about how to do nonviolent resistance and the awareness of what the consequences of not doing it nonviolence and what the Israelis are doing to the nonviolent resistors, those two things could just sum up to a tipping point, a rapid change.
Yes, and if I may say that in the Middle East, they would welcome this shows their Yep. position. They would welcome any nonviolent steps that's taken. It's ironic that peace always, as we think about it, is as Israel try to teach us what peace is. And the reality is Israel is very complicit in oppressing any peace gestures or any peace talk per se, from all the peaceful organizations, as you talk, or the publications?
That's an understatement. You know, when you think about what they did to your friend, and I've mm-hmm. heard him speak, Mubarak Awad, mm-hmm. you know, when he started talking about nonviolence there and mm-hmm. teaching people what the essence of nonviolence is, they basically picked him up, put him on a plane, and shipped him out. Yep. It's very threatening. Nonviolence is yes. very threatening yeah. to power.
And that's a good sign.
Yes.
Because, I mean, when all is said and done, the Israelis are pretty smart. And they do understand that they cannot really resist nonviolence successfully. My friend Stephen Zunis, who really knows a great deal about the Middle East, pointed out that when they threw Mubarak out of the country, they didn't touch Sheikh Yassin, though he was doing all kinds of assassinations and suicide bombings and so forth, because they knew that made their narrative make sense, and in the end that they could deal with it. But so I think we can get some kind of hope out of this.
So I want to say that this is one of those to-be-continued interviews, because the topic is so big and so everybody here is so passionate about it. So before we go into our next segment, which is nonviolence in the news, I was wondering if both Therese and Amin could just give us some last words in terms of either what you think people in the United States and around the world should be getting involved in particular, that might be a good, you know, helping a solution for both Palestinians and Israelis and the rest of the world who's complicit in the situation, or resources to get involved or learn more. Amin, let's start with you, since we had Therese start the interview off.
Thank you. Well, the problem is so complex, but I'm not trying over here to portray it as a naive person by saying it is so simple also. And that simplicity, I could address anybody, any American. If the United States, who is our government representing us, will abide by international law, by civil rights, human rights, that will actually right the wrong regarding the Palestinian problem. And this is the core of the problem. The core of the problem is whether we are going to be passive about violation of the international law, violation of civil rights, violation of human rights. We have to be accountable to that. And I could sum it up with that.
Thank you.
And also with that, I mean, not to be simplistic, and since we've been talking about nonviolent means, there is nothing more perfect than nonviolent boycott, divestment, and sanctions of a rogue state such as Israel, I believe, and many other people in the world believe Israel is. And, you know, the apartheid situation in South Africa was brought down by people becoming aware of what was going on and actually putting their dollars where their values are. And I think we can do it in this country too, and it's beginning. It's happening. It's happening. People are adhering to BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, in a way that will, in a nonviolent way, bring down the oppression of the Palestinians.
And I'm happy to say that the colleges are playing their role once again, you know, as an old member of the free speech movement, that campuses are picking this up.
And there's a lot of resistance to that as well.
There is, yeah.
Yes. But, you know, it is in the colleges. In South Africa, it was mm-hmm. the UC Berkeley's of the world that really finally gave it that last push. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what we need to do to strengthen those movements on our campuses and engage the young students, you know, the student leaderships.
Well, I would like just to add one thing. I think if we could achieve the point of one man, one vote, equality for everyone from any faith, any ethnic background, we could live peacefully. This is a message for the rest of the world, and we could implement it in Palestine easily for all parties.
I have one final question for you. I mean, right after the Six Days War, I was walking around in East Jerusalem, And an Arab boy came up to me and it was very happy to see me and invited me to his house for coffee. Was that you?
No, unfortunately. I wish I was. But 1967, as a matter of fact, happened when I was outside. And that, of course, everything snowballed to come to the United States as immigrant. So, but it is not far from my mentality or anybody there.
Or any Palestinian.
Or any Palestinian.
Hospitality is our biggest quality.
Yes.
Our biggest.
Yeah.
Yes. We experienced that.
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much for just even, we haven't even scratched the surface. We've just been ice skating around on top of it at this time. So I hope that we can have you back on the show another time and continue the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And so let's take a short break and we will then get back to you with some nonviolence in the news. So for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and we were just speaking with Therese Muganam and Amin Khalaf about the situation in Palestine, but also about being Palestinian in the diaspora. And that's a huge conversation. It's a huge topic, and definitely go out and get more information about what you heard on the show and compare that to your own experiences and see if you learned something new or you were inspired in a new way. But now let's turn to a little bit of nonviolence in the news before we sign off for the day. Michael Nagler.
Thank you, Stephanie. And a little bit is right. There's so much that I could be reporting on, but it was wonderful to spend that time with our guests. Well, as usual, I'd like to mention a couple of resources. I've mentioned one already, Iyad Bernat's book, Bila'in and the Nonviolent Resistance, which we'll be having copies of at the Meta Center shortly. Also, there is a new online journal called the Peace Science Digest, which provides access and analyses to academic research in the field. I am not one who believes that academic research is our most potent mechanism, but it has its role to play. We've often cited the wonderful findings of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan on this program. And in that general line, there is a global campaign for peace education, and they have a new website service as a clearinghouse for peace education news. So you can find that on peace-ed-campaign.org. I have been saving a very inspiring piece of news. I'd like to share that with you right now. We will probably go back to it with some details shortly. But we've often talked on this program about Nonviolent Peace Force because of the extremely record-breaking, innovative work that they do around the world in a field that's now called UCP, which stands for Unarmed Civilian Peacekeeping or Unarmed Civilian Protection, depending how you'd like to interpret it. Well, mind you, this is now in the peace movement. The Dutch Ministry of Foreign Affairs for South Sudan has just made a grant to Nonviolent Peace Force for the work of protecting women and children against gender-based violence in South Sudan, which has been extreme and appalling. And that grant is in the sum of $8.2 million. So that's more money than I have ever dreamed of in 30 years of working in the peace movement. And interestingly enough, if you go on the website of Nonviolent Peace Force, they give you a simple comparison. What can you buy for Syria? Well, for $4 million, you can put one rebel on the ground who has a 90% chance of defecting at one point or another, and a 100% chance of making matters worse. Mm-hmm. For half of that amount, $2 million, we could finally build up what Nonviolent Peace Force has been wanting to do for 15 years now, 2,000 courageous, diverse civil society leaders committed to preventing violence and improving the situation. So that's a neat comparison. Half the cost of one rebel would give us a complete nonviolent peace force. So moving on from there, we've had a number of small successes. There's a new bill that's about to be introduced in Congress that would solidify recent gains in the peace building field and strengthen the nation's ability to avoid the next military entanglement. I suppose some of you, like myself, have our favorite bumper sticker, the one that says, "I'm already against the next war." Well, learning lessons and going forward, this bill is called the Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act. It's been introduced by Senator Ben Cardin, who is a Democrat from Maryland, and he's the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to that as it threads its way through that Byzantine process of legislation in this country. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit, and I had wanted to ask Amin about this. We spoke about it on the way here, about President Obama's recent executive order and his, as the newspapers are saying, his emotional appeal for gun safety. I want to point out that recently the profits of the gun manufacturing in the U.S. have surpassed the profits of Apple Computer, and that America is still providing more than half of the arms sales abroad. So what is really the status of the various mechanisms that President Obama has proposed? He wants to insist on licensing and background checks. So, for example, that very deranged young man who carried out the most painful massacre of them all, so far the killing of school children in Newtown, Connecticut. And the president said, every time I think about those kids, it makes me mad. But he wasn't really mad. He was crying. So make that not possible. Close various legal loopholes. Provide more mental health care and more rapid response for domestic violence, and elaborate and support the gun safety technology. Well, what is our analysis from the nonviolent point of view? From our point of view, this will do a little bit of good as a concrete mechanism. It'll be a little bit harder for an extremely deranged, angry person to buy assault rifles and go out and commit mayhem. But it's more important as a symbolic statement that we think gun violence is wrong, guns are meant to kill people, and the purpose of government is to protect its citizenry. That's called the Kadushot HiBatachon in Hebrew, that the government has its responsibility towards its people. So as a symbolic statement, as a first response to the tragedies that have become epidemic in what I call the new abnormal, it's going to be more important than the actual concrete changes that it can introduce. But now, unfortunately, I think we need to talk a little bit about what the proposal doesn't address. He did not dare for one second to talk about what is really causing the violence. Mm. The violence, here the NRA in a peculiar, ironic way is right. Guns don't kill people. That is, they don't jump off the shelf and kill people by themselves. People kill people, but it's people who are alienated and are alienated from themselves and from others that kill people. And what's causing this alienation is a tremendous amount of violence on the mass media. When we get to a point where we can face that fact, address it, and do something about it, then we'll see a really profound change.
Mm-hmm. And Michael, you might be interested to know, because one project that I'm working on at Meta with the Shanti Sena Network, mm-hmm. and I invite people to go to the Meta Center's website, get in contact with me to find out more, but it's about how we can respond to an active shooter using some of the principles of nonviolence. It's a big question. But anyways, the FBI put out a video about what to do with an active shooter situation, which gets some things right. You know, mm-hmm. you should protect yourself. Yeah. This starts off, sometimes life seems more like an action movie. And they start, right, like that. So, but you know what? Nonviolence can be like an action movie. Why do all the action movies have to be violent action? Nonviolent action is wonderful. That's what we talk about here on Peace Paradigm Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook. That was Michael Nagler with the news. You're listening to this on KWMR and 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, 92.3 San Geronimo Valley. Thanks to everybody at the Meta Center. To all of our listeners. Until the next time, take care of one another. Bye, everyone.